It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, across the universe. One thing we love to do on this show is talk about big ideas. And there's no bigger idea, literally, than the universe. Today, we travel across time and space, wonder what it would be like to walk on Mars, and reflect on an unforgettable childhood visit to a planetarium.
I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck, star-struck, really, by it.
But first, there is actually one thing that could be bigger than the universe, and that's the multiverse. Theoretical physicist Max Tegmark is one of the leading proponents of the idea that we could be living in just one of many universes. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about his new book, Our Mathematical Universe.
Max, you have a rather audacious theory that reality is ultimately a mathematical structure. Not just that math describes our universe, but that our universe is made out of math, that it's a giant mathematical object. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, this sounds kind of crazy. We look around ourselves in the world and it doesn't look particularly mathematical at all. But yet, we physicists have, of course, discovered that everything in our universe is made of these elementary particles, like quarks and electrons. And if you ask, what properties does an electron actually have? You know, my friend Anthony's little son was shocked when his dad told him that electrons don't actually have a color. He was like, what? How can an object not have a color? But now, as far as we can tell, electrons have the only properties they actually have are minus one, one half, one, and so on. And although we've made up these nerdy names for these properties like electric charge and spin and Lipton number, they're just mathematical properties. They're numbers. And if you look at space itself, where we find all these particles, what properties does space have? It has the property three, the largest number of pencils you can hold perpendicularly to one another, right?
Wait, again, space has the property of three. It sounds like we're getting into Douglas Adams territory in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Of course, you know, what is the secret to life in the universe? The number 42.
Oh, yeah. I am such a big Douglas Adams fan that you probably found my book to be peppered with Douglas Adams references. And as far as we can tell, you know, neither space itself nor the particles actually have any properties at all except for mathematical properties. And for example, by just studying mathematics, the planet Neptune was discovered. The radio wave was discovered. And most recently, Peter Higgs sat down with the most advanced mathematical description we physicists ever came up with. He did a bunch of math, and then he predicted that if we build the most advanced scientific instrument ever built in Geneva and use it to smash particles together near the speed of light in a certain way, we would there discover a new particle, the Higgs boson. You know how that went? We built it. Boom, there it was. And he won a free trip to my hometown of Stockholm. And this is just one of many, many examples where this mathematical perspective of the world turns out to not just be a nifty perspective on things, but actually just really useful.
So do you find mathematics beautiful? I mean, is this why you originally became a theoretical physicist, to try to uncover this underlying mathematical structure?
I think there are two parallel tracks that have been going on in my own personal life, actually. I always loved math as a kid, and particularly beautiful mathematical pictures. I was so excited the first time I saw pictures of fractals, for example. And in parallel with that, though, as a kid, I was always very curious about to discover things. I loved detective mysteries. And when a big light bulb went off in my head, it was really when it hit me as a teenager that physics itself is the ultimate detective story. We get to find all these mathematical clues, and then we get to be part of this amazing community of detectives who have worked for hundreds of years to piece together this incredible plot that we're uncovering of what nature is really up to.
Now, there's another thing that you talk about in your book. I mean, you also argue that reality is more than just our observable universe, going back to the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, that there are actually many universes. We live in some sort of a multiverse. What makes you think that?
Before we talk about other universes, though, let's just remind ourselves what we mean by our universe. We don't mean by that in astronomy what I thought we meant as kids, namely everything that exists, which by definition would mean there couldn't be others. What we mean by our universe in astronomy is simply the spherical region of space from which light has had time to reach us so far during the 13.8 billion years since our Big Bang. Okay, so if there are galaxies that are much farther away, even the best telescopes on the planet can never see them, because we would have to wait, you know, billions of years more for the light to reach us. And the question is there more than just this space that we have access to, our universe? And the reason people have started talking about this a lot now, not just in science fiction, but also at physics conferences, is because even though we can't go see those regions directly, we have a bunch of mathematical physics theories, which we've started to take seriously for other reasons, because they made other successful predictions, which actually predict that they should exist. But it also predicts that space itself is much bigger than the part that we can see, perhaps even infinite.
No, wait, I have to jump in, because I've always heard that space is not infinite. I mean, there's sort of an outer edge of space. And I mean, that when we talk about our universe expanding, that's what that is. I mean, to that outer edge. But you're saying actually space goes on forever?
This is a very fascinating misconception that a lot of people have, that we somehow know that there's an end to space. And in fact, I got asked this question by a 5-year-old kindergartner when I gave a talk recently. Does space go on forever? And I was just so impressed that this 5-year-old, you know, was able to ask a science question that I couldn't answer and none of us knows the answer to right now. The basic fact of the matter is we don't know. Einstein came up with more elegant ways in which space could be finite. You could go really far in one direction and just find that you're back in Wisconsin again from the other direction. But this inflation theory that we have, what it actually does is it stretches space out and produces more volume everywhere. It predicts that space is vastly bigger than the part that we can see. So there are all these other regions teeming with galaxies and planets and stars. This is the first kind that I call the level one parallel universes in the book. It's just one space. We all share the same Big Bang. It's just that stuff, history played out differently.
Well, and I've heard the phrase pocket universes, as if they, you know, they're sort of pockets of these different universes all within this one giant multiverse.
Ah, so now you're going to the level two multiverse.
Oh, okay.
Where you effectively have many different Big Bangs, and each one creates one of these pocket universes. And this is also something which the inflation theory predicts. And it actually isn't quite as shocking as you might think, because in physics, whenever you have a mechanism that creates something, if you have a car factory, it produces a car, you know, it's not so strange to think that it could produce many cars. In fact, they usually do. And so if you have some kind of Big Bang creation mechanism going on in physics, you could imagine it making many bangs.
Now, you have other versions of multiple universes as well, something that you call the level three multiverse. And this, I have to say, this starts to get really strange. I mean, this gets into what has been called the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. The world is constantly splitting into alternative realities. Can you explain this?
So this is a multiverse which has been brought to us from a completely different direction. When you start zooming in to the micro world instead and ask what everything is made out of, you discover these particles and you start studying them. Quantum mechanics governs this. And the supreme law of the land there is what's known as the Schrödinger equation. And it's arguably the most successful physics theory ever. It's given us the transistor, the computer revolution, cell phones, lasers, you name it. But for about 100 years now, physicists have also argued about this, what to really make of it. And the reason is the textbook version of this theory, the Copenhagen interpretation, as it's called, is kind of incomplete, because the Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics says that little particles can be in multiple places at once. And I'm, of course, made of particles, right? So that means I can be in several places at once. But you never see that, your friend being in several places at once, at least sober. So this Copenhagen stuff invented this extra thing called the collapse of the wave function, which was supposed to randomly get rid of all the different versions of you except one and bring back order and make it the way we see it. But in the 1950s, a young grad student named Hugh Everett came up with this really radical idea that forget about all that Copenhagen collapse stuff and say that this equation always holds, no exceptions at all. Then you can really end up in two places at once. For example, if you're making a snap decision about where to hit your shot in a tennis game, whether to do a lob or a passing shot, you know, that might come down to just what one atom is doing in your brain that then escalates through your neural network processing. And suddenly the whole tennis ball is in two places at once, and then either you won the Wimbledon final or you didn't, and now you're in two different places, and things totally branch out into basically two parallel realities.
But there's no way that I mean, I would never have any contact with this other universe. I mean, it's just off in some other dimension, and there's physically it would be impossible for me to visit that other universe.
Well, people for a long time dismissed this, saying even if it's true, it doesn't have any practical relevance. But the reason people are getting more interested in it now is because you can actually use this weirdness, if it's actually true, to calculate certain things faster by building so-called quantum computers. So there are certain math problems which would take longer than the age of the universe to solve on a normal machine, which one of these quantum computers might be able to do in under a minute.
But the quantum computer still cannot get into the other parallel universe, can it?
Well, the way it actually works, one way you can think about it is that it's running the ultimate sort of parallel processing by tapping into the computational power of these parallel universes and then ultimately putting it all together for you and telling you, here is the answer. So we don't know yet whether they're going to work or not. If we do build these machines, and there's millions and millions of dollars right now invested in this endeavor, and if they work, then I think actually a lot of physicists are going to start taking much more seriously that these parallel universes exist.
Now, there are a lot of people, including a lot of physicists, who think all of this is a crackpot idea. I mean, you are talking about things that are so theoretical, so removed from the empirical world of scientific experiment, of testability, that you're taking physics off into what the science writer Jim Baggett calls fairy tale physics.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that criticism?
It's a very, very important question to bring up. You know, is this really science or is it just science fiction or pure speculation? So the lines are blurred. And why is that? Well, basically because the difference between science and science fiction is whether something is testable or not, right? But parallel universes are not a theory. They're a prediction of certain theories. And if we don't like those parallel universes, well, then we have to come up with a theory that's better than inflation, that doesn't have space going beyond where we can see, but which can still explain successfully all the other things inflation had.
But the problem with multiple universes is you're talking about a different universe that we can never go to. I mean, almost by definition, we can't. I mean, maybe there's some theory.
Right.
I mean, it would seem that that is not testable then.
You're quite right. We can never go test the parallel universe's existence by going there and looking at them by definition. That's not testable. But the theory that predicted them is testable. So what I'm saying is if you buy the theory, you need to buy the prediction. Similarly, black holes, what happens inside them, we consider science because Einstein's theory of gravity predicts what happens in black holes, right? Is that testable directly by flying into a black hole and then coming back and reporting on NPR what you found? No way. Black holes are like a one-way trip. If you enter the event horizon, sorry, you know, game over. So you cannot confirm what happens inside black holes in that traditional scientific way by flying there and looking. But that doesn't mean that black holes are science fiction. So we can't opt out of predictions of a theory unless we also reject the theory itself.
Max Tegmark is a theoretical physicist at MIT. He talked with Steve about his new book, Our Mathematical Universe. These multiverse theories are kind of mind-blowing and controversial. But for a truly earth-shattering controversy in physics, let's go back 500 years. In 1514, the astronomer Nicholas Copernicus floated a revolutionary idea to a few friends that the sun, not the earth, is the center of our solar system. The idea was so radical, Copernicus refused even to publish it. Davis Sobel tells the story in A More Perfect Heaven. When the book first came out, she told Jim Fleming it's hard to appreciate how transformative this idea once was.
School children today know it. The rest of us know it only because we've been told. It's not at all obvious that the earth is in motion. It certainly doesn't feel as though it's moving, does it?
No. No, and I guess that what you then move immediately onto is the realization that the whole world was different. The world into which Copernicus was born was in a lot of ways not at all like the world in which we live, was it?
Not at all. And he was involved in so many things. He was a cleric in the church, but then he was also a medical doctor, his bishop's personal physician. And because of the Knights of the Teutonic Order who lived all around the area of Poland where he grew up and then spent his adulthood, he was actually engaged in active warfare from time to time. And then there was great religious upheaval. It was during Copernicus's time that Martin Luther broke from the Catholic Church, not to mention Columbus's travels while Copernicus was a college student.
The whole world was changing, in other words. And in the midst of all of this, Copernicus is, of course, contemplating a change in the way people will think about the planet and on which they live. And we see that again as revolutionary. Did he see it as big a change as we do?
Yes, indeed. He knew it was a monumental change, and that was part of what gave him his anxiety. He knew it was philosophically difficult, that it seemed to go against common sense, and people might ridicule him. And, of course, he feared a religious backlash.
What was different about Copernicus that caused him to see the world differently?
No one really knows that. But when he saw how putting the sun at the center would organize the planets in order of their speed, he knew he'd hit on something powerfully important. And even though there was an ancient Greek mathematician, Aristarchus, who had considered putting the sun at the center, Copernicus actually didn't know that. So he was alone and felt alone and was frightened of what would happen if he publicized his idea.
Well, this brings us back to Rheticus, who's at the center of your story, this young Lutheran man who braved a trip into Catholic territory where he was forbidden.
Yes. Their meeting was so important because it united these two people, one old, one young, the different religions, but they came together over that idea, and then it was that book that really did change the world.
But it must have been extraordinary because, well, we start with the fact that Rheticus came into a place where he knew he wasn't wanted, and then persuaded a man who had been afraid his whole life to publish this book to change his mind.
Convinced Copernicus to do what he'd avoided doing for a lifetime.
Yeah.
That must have been some conversation.
Now, of course, what he published is not the Copernican universe that we see today. It was an early version of it.
Well, we no longer think that the sun is the center of the universe, but only the center of the solar system.
It took the work of Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler to expand upon the Copernican theory?
Indeed. Tycho brought many more and better observations to bear. Yet he couldn't accept Copernicus's theory. And one of the reasons he couldn't accept it, he couldn't accept the expanded cosmos. For Copernicus's idea to be correct, the stars had to be much farther away than people had thought. And Tycho couldn't believe that either. And so he clung to the idea of the Earth at the center. He put all the other planets in orbit around the sun and had that whole whirligig moving around the Earth. It was Kepler who worked as Tycho's assistant for a while and then used his much improved data to see the reality of the elliptical orbits.
What was the reaction of the world at large when this book was published?
His book came into print with an anonymous preface that he didn't know about, that told people not to take the idea too seriously, that it was just another way of thinking about doing the calculations. So he was protected from any outright criticism for a while. It was only when Galileo's discoveries began to provide a body of evidence for what Copernicus had suggested, and when Galileo began speaking out in favor of Copernicus, it was at that point that the church took issue with Copernicus.
Not during his lifetime, basically, but
no,
later.
He died as soon as the book was finished, so he never knew what the response to it was. But the big question in the way people look at this issue is whether humanity was demoted from a place of central importance. I think at the time, the center was not considered an exalted place. It was merely different, profoundly different from everything else. So all the heavenly bodies were thought to be made of a perfect, everlasting, unchanging substance, whereas things on the earth were made of earth and water and air and fire. And there was lots of change, and there was death and decay. So it wasn't the best place in the universe. That was reserved for the heavenly bodies and all the way out beyond the stars, God and the angels. And the bigger problem for Copernicus was taking the Earth and making it a wandering star like the other planets, making this pit of decay a celestial body, and taking the sun out of the heavens and putting it at the center. This was a philosophical conflict of great depth.
Deva Sobel talked with Jim Fleming about her book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. Coming up, how to visit Mars without leaving Earth. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about what's out there at the edge of the cosmos, and no one makes the case for the wonder of astrophysics better than Neil deGrasse Tyson. He runs the country's most famous planetarium, he's a frequent guest on late-night TV, and now he's hosting the reboot of the late Carl Sagan's famous series Cosmos. Tyson has a story of his own first experience of the wonder of the cosmos. He was 9 years old on his first visit to the Hayden Planetarium, the place he now runs.
There's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room, and the light's dim. You don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. I thought it was a hoax at first. I was born in the Bronx. I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. And here were thousands. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck. Star-struck, really. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder. Here's what I wonder, though. Suppose I grew up on a farm, and the actual night sky was there from birth, from my first wanderings out onto the porch. Would I ever have taken it for granted, such that a first visit to a planetarium wouldn't have been any different from what I saw from my backyard, and so it would have less impact on me? I always wonder about that. What we found, and what I found personally, but research also shows, that in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark on your memory and on your emotions and on your mind, it's got to be bigger than you are. And that will greatly increase the chances that it'll be unforgettable. Think about it. You are transported into space. You're moving through space. It is bigger than you are. The good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disruptive, who is quiet when they're told to be quiet, who is seated and not fidgeting when they're told to be seated and not fidgeting. That is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is I have this energy, gurgling within me. It's bubbling over. I've got to express it somehow. I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery. What we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious. And it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity. They already have the wonder. My worry is, how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here. It's, you know, for every adult that says, how can I get my kid interested in science? I said, the kid is already interested in science. It's you I got the problems with. The kids are already curious about the natural world. And left to themselves, they will explore it.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is director of the Hayden Planetarium. Joe Hartke did the sound design. Most of what we just heard is from NASA's own sound library, including the sped-up sound of the Big Bang itself. And speaking of wonder, what would it be like to set foot on Mars? There are places on this planet where you can actually get a good idea, and you don't need a spaceship to get there. Writer Craig Childs just wrote a great magazine piece about exploring Mars analogs. It's called How to Visit Another Planet Without Leaving Your Own. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Craig, I have no desire to visit Mars. It looks cold and bleak and forbidding, and you can't breathe the air, and there's nothing to drink. You, on the other hand, confessed in the pages of Orion magazine that you would like to hike on Mars. Why?
So I didn't convince you?
I'm afraid not.
Well, the desolate properties. I'm a desert traveler, and I like to travel in glacial landscapes, you know, places that are very exposed. But also the size of the landforms on Mars, just the enormity of Olympus Mons and the deep canyons. I just think, oh, that would be such a wild sensation to go out and actually just walk across that planet.
You know, that's fascinating. You're talking about Mars in a way that we've only been able to do fairly recently. Because if you think, I mean, going back since the 70s, NASA has been sending satellites and probes and then finally rovers to Mars. And the photographs have been getting better and better and also more and more specific so that you can now do what you just did, I guess, pick out particular landscapes, particular places on Mars that you'd like to visit.
Well, they've become so clear that now we're looking at it saying, oh, well, this isn't some planet made of cheese. This is actually a planet that looks like ours in many ways, without the life, without the masses of open water, but it looks like the same principles you see here. You see rocks exposed with geologic layers, with bedding plains. You know, you see dunes, you see glaciers and moraines. The pictures we're getting make me want to walk there.
Are there particular photos you've seen that have just really wowed you? I mean, you've looked at places and said, okay, that goes on my bucket list?
Oh, yeah. There are some craters. I think it's Gusev Crater has a dune field, a sand dune field, right in the middle of it. And I just imagine walking to the edge of that crater and looking down to this enormous sand dune field and climbing down into it and just walking over the crests.
Wow. Where else?
Oh, along the edge of the polar ice caps, where big pieces of ice have fallen off and are just scattered around, melting and just covered with the red dust. I want to see some of those big dust devils that are rolling across the landscape out there, some out on the big desert plains.
Okay, you're almost convincing me. Well, the point of your article, though, is that there are places on Earth that are kind of like Mars, Mars analogs, you called them, which happen to be a lot of the places that you've hiked, for example.
Well, what comes right to mind is the Atacama Desert in South America. It's a landscape that I find beautiful, that I don't think a lot of people would find that way, but it's a place where in many parts of the desert, rain hasn't fallen for decades or even centuries or even for the entire history of gathering rain data. These places are just absolutely barren, but you know, barren to me is really enticing because you can see the shapes of the earth. You can see the way that rocks are sticking up in the air and just brutalized by winds and turned into these sculptures. And it looks like Mars. It really does.
Is it all flat? Are there mountains?
No, there are mountains. There are these big flat areas called salars, these salt depressions that you just take days walking across them, and then it rises up into a 2,000-foot ridge made entirely of salt that's jagged and bizarrely eroded. It's like walking into a salt castle. And then you come down the other side into the next salar and eventually rises up to mountains that are standing 19,000 feet.
Wow. You said it's all this salt, crystallized salt. That makes me think of a landscape that would be sharp, pointy.
Yes.
Hurtful.
It is. There are times I was backpacking across one of these salt regions, and we just could not find any place to even sit down. And we were walking into the night for hours until we found a spot that we could crawl into to sleep. It just would tear you apart. And I guess that's not convincing you either, is it?
Well, I'm fascinated because I'm curious about what draws you to these places, to places that are, you know, really inhospitable.
I think it's the elemental quality. And don't get me wrong, I love forests and lakes, but it just, when you strip everything else away and look at the bare bones of things, that is a different experience.
You said there's not been any rain there for decades, so obviously that's kind of like Mars. When you're there, does it feel like the moisture is just being sucked out of your body with every minute?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you're carrying your water on your back, and your skin is drying, and you're doing everything to keep the sun off of your skin. I'd walk with the sun to my back, which would really control the travel during the day, because after a while, you just can't walk into the sun. It just, you feel like you're going to pop.
So how long were you hiking there?
Well, that was a trip that was only probably 9 days of carrying water.
You carried enough water for 9 days?
Yeah.
How much
heavy.
Water is that?
9 gallons.
Now, this is a place, the Atacama Desert, I think, that NASA used to test some of the Viking landers.
Right. Testing the biotic properties of being able to determine if there's life or not. That was their one of their target locations.
And so what did they find in the Atacama?
That there is no life. That if you would have landed a rover on the Earth and it landed there, it would report back that the Earth is a dead planet.
See, I had no idea there were even places like that on Earth, places that are dead.
Actually, if you drill down into the salt, you find microbes. And that's what we'd be missing on Mars, is that we haven't gone down under the surface, really.
So I'm curious, what does it feel like to be in a place that is really kind of not on a biological scale?
You feel like you got sneaked in, that you're not supposed to be there. And I guess in a way it would be like sneaking into a museum at night or something where you're not allowed to be. And that's what it feels like on a grand scale of living creatures are not allowed to be here. And yet here you are walking across it. It feels like magic.
And we haven't talked about beauty. We've talked about the ruggedness and the harshness, but do these places also seem, does the Atacama seem beautiful to you?
Oh, yeah. I can imagine dull landscapes, but these are not. The salt formations are elegant. You have this huge sky sitting on top of these rough formations. It is like walking through a sculpture gallery. It is really quite beautiful on many scales.
Because I was thinking, there's such a long tradition, at least in the West, of admiring landscapes that are teeming with life in some way. You know, we love forests and lush meadows and rivers and oceans and snow-capped mountains. And I was wondering whether to appreciate this kind of Martian-style landscape, maybe we'd need to cultivate a different kind of aesthetic.
Yeah, I think that we've got to look at the harshness as beauty. And I don't think everybody can do that. I think to live on Mars, to spend any time there, you'd need to understand landscapes differently. You'd have to take them into yourself differently and really consider a different kind of beauty.
Another place you've been that you consider a Mars analog is an ice sheet in Greenland. So a very cold location. What's Mars like about it?
It's even more sparse.
Nothing but white and sky?
Yeah, because you don't have terrain. You have crevasses, but you don't see them until you're right on them. You're just looking across a white horizon. When you're standing out in it and you're away from your camp, the Earth is two things. It's sky and snow, and that's it.
in your article, you said that you kind of made a bet with the ice scientists there that they said you couldn't walk a straight line out there, that nobody can.
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know. Our brains are just not... We've never lived in a place that doesn't have landmarks, that doesn't have something to cue off of. And I tried and tried. At one point, I was walking out away from camp and just looking at the ground. I didn't have any references. My hood was covering the horizon. And I thought I was walking in a straight line. And after 15 minutes, I looked up and there was camp straight ahead of me. I turned completely around.
You wrote something that was sort of amazing to me. You said the water there, and I guess you melt the snow or the ice to drink, it's so pure you can't drink it straight?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have anything in it, no minerals, no salt. So it actually starts pulling minerals and salts out of your stomach lining, and you get a stomach ache. So you have to add tea or lemonade or something to it.
I read that and I thought that was the moment where I got this visceral sense of how profoundly inhospitable to human life that kind of landscape is.
Yeah, that is not a place where we can live. When I looked at our time there, and it was a small camp, a 7-person research station, I just thought the only way you can live out here is to have a whole civilization behind you. You know, infrastructure of transport planes and all kinds of stuff that allow you to survive out here. Because otherwise, I mean, you leave your little tent in the night and you stand out there in 60-mile-an-hour wind, and you realize that you would last, you know, a minute or two if you were just thrown into this place, that you feel the fact that you are dying when you step outside and you're not properly protected. And to be there for days, weeks is it's like being on Mars, I suppose.
Craig Childs is the author, most recently, of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. His essay about walking on Mars is in Orion Magazine. Coming up, from outer space to the inner psyche. In a few minutes, we'll talk with novelist Laurie Moore about her long-awaited new book of short stories. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Kat Duff, the author of The Alchemy of Illness and The Secret Life of Sleep. If my house were on fire and there was only one book that I could grab from my shelves, it would be Awakening Osiris, a translation of The Egyptian Book of the Dead by Normandie Ellis. Even though we call it the Book of the Dead, the Egyptians knew of it as the Book of Coming Forth by Day. It is a compilation of hymns and work songs and love songs and prayers and meditations celebrating life. It celebrates life. When I had to move my 60-year-old friend into the nursing home because we could no longer give her the 24/7 care that she needed with her disabilities, I visited her every day, and every day I read a page out of Awakening Osiris. When our beloved ER doc committed suicide, I pulled that book from my shelf. This is the book I turn to for those precarious passages that we endure periodically in life. It reminds me And I find this so comforting. It reminds me that we are always changing and always becoming. You know, my copy of that book is so dog-eared and has so many pages turned and so many little marks and so many. I've used it for so many occasions. I've read from it out loud. I've read from it for friends. One of the things that's interesting about these really ancient texts, they don't have a single author. They are a common voice of many peoples that has withstood the test of time. And when we can encounter those, it's like finding another species we didn't know existed. It has a wonder to it, a freshness. It's just so remarkable, so awesome. The last time I looked at Awakening Osiris was when my godson's baby was born, just a few weeks ago. It talked about the path of life and the many paths of lives and how beautiful each and everything is, even in its difficulties, even in its pains and its sufferings, that it is such grace that we get to be born and have a life.
Kat Duff, with her recommendation, Awakening Osiris, a translation of the Egyptian Book of the Dead by Normandie Ellis. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. It's August, the dog days of summer. A good time to pick up Laurie Moore's latest short story collection, Bark. When she talked with Steve Paulson, he asked her to read a bit from the beginning of the first story in the new collection.
Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. The ring, supposedly gold, though now that everything he had ever received from Marilyn had been thrown into doubt, who knew, cinched the blousy fat of his finger, which had grown around it like a happy vine. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. She'll understand the reference. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Mike's job, approving historical preservation projects on old houses, left him time to take a lot of lenient parenting courses and to read all the lenient parenting books. Here's what you do for your depression. I'm not going to say, lose yourself in charity work. I'm not going to say, get some perspective by watching our country's news each evening and by contemplating those worse off than yourself. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days and start everything back up again. Bam! I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
That is great. Laurie, how would you describe Ira, the main character in this story, debarking?
Ira, how would I describe him? Oh, he's a bit hapless, isn't he? And he's in a state of high anxiety, and he really falls for someone who's really...
All wrong for him.
All wrong for him, but she's beautiful, and so he can't help himself. So he just falls for her and then has to extricate himself. So,
now, there are some recurring themes in this new collection of stories, particularly the difficulties of finding love and holding on to a relationship, especially in middle age. And I have to say, they tend not to work out very well in your stories. And is it fair to say that most of your characters have trouble with relationships?
I think it's fair to say that most characters in everybody's fiction have trouble with relationships. I can't think of a single writer who writes about characters who have no trouble, whether you're talking about Flaubert or Tolstoy or John Updike or whomever you want to talk about. That's just where the stories are. But this is, you know, it's the stuff of life. And it's what we all talk about, and it's what writers write about.
Now, you also have a ghost story.
I do have
collection,
a ghost story.
Juniper Tree, in which your narrator visits a friend who's just died, but it turns out the dead woman is still kind of hanging around telling the narrator things she really doesn't want to hear. What made you want to write a ghost story?
Well, a friend of mine actually died, and I had a dream about her that was so vivid that it was like a visitation. And I said to someone the next day, do you think there's such a thing as dead people actually visiting you in your sleep? Or does that sound insane? He said, it does sound insane. You mustn't tell anyone. But he said he had had the same experience and that many people do. I mean, you can have dreams that are so vivid, you just think, that's not really a dream.
But I had one of those too.
You did?
Yeah.
With someone who had died?
With my grandmother right after she died.
See? Yeah. I think there's a way in which, I don't know, the dream self can access some other, I don't know. Now I'm going to stop talking because I will sound crazy. The vividness of the dream prompted me to write this story. It's not a transcription of the dream, but it's very much prompted by the dream.
Is this fertile ground for you as a writer to
dreams?
Ghost stories?
Well, I have taken to telling my students to put a ghost in their stories because, you know, it's a time-tested element in literature. You know, Shakespeare did it. Dickens did it. Ghosts are great. James did it. Literature's full of ghosts, and they can do a lot of interesting storytelling work, psychological work.
But a lot of those ghosts in fiction, like, you know, Henry James, they're kind of horror stories. Yours is not that way.
Well, you use a ghost for whatever purposes you use it, but in this story, the ghost is sort of a figure of rebuke for the narrator who has a little bit of both grief and remorse and guilt to cope with.
And the ghost is there to remind her
to remind
all of those things.
Right. To rebuke her slightly, yes. Gently, gently.
One of the trademarks of your writing, something you're famous for, is the way you manage to combine both funny and awful. Sometimes in the same paragraph, even the same sentence, you know, sort of looking for the humor in our anxiety, our misery. And I guess I'm wondering if that's sort of the way you often see the world, you know,
of
in daily
course.
Life. Or is that more of a writerly sensibility?
I don't know. I think it's the way the world is. There's a lot of absurdity and there's a lot of funny stuff surrounding really, really hard and difficult and sad stuff. And it's just there, and it's up to you whether you want to take note of it or not. I guess it's a sensibility, but
yeah,
it's also a fact of life.
Now, if we step back from your stories for a moment and just talk about the art of the short story in general, what do you think makes a really good short story?
You know, many things. I think the short story is such a limber and varied form that you can look at any number of stories that are very, very different, and they can all be good. So the primary thing is, of course, that you give the reader an experience of something. And it probably should be a psychological experience, an experience that has both intelligence and emotion in it. And the story probably should have a voice. But those are very general ideas.
Do you think that experience is different than reading a novel?
Well, it's a briefer experience, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's an experience that has to happen in one sitting. You know, a novel, you keep going back. You can read 5 minutes here, 2 hours there. A story has to be read in a single sitting from beginning to end. But different stories require different things. I mean, Alice Munro has stories that are 60 pages. And, you know, it might take over an hour.
And she somehow manages to compress what almost feels like a novel into a short story. I don't know how she does it, but...
Well, I think she does it by starting to write a novel. I mean, she has said that so many of her stories started out as novels. She thought they would be novels, and she got to page 60, and they were done.
you have written both short stories and novels. Do you approach them differently? I mean, other than the fact that one is a lot longer than the other, do you think about them differently?
One takes years, and one you hope will only take a week and usually takes months. So they are very different in that way, at least for me.
You had said that one should read a short story in one sitting. Does that translate to writing as well?
Well, if you could get a draft out in a single sitting, that would be perfect. But at some point, you have to go through your short story and see it completely as somebody would who's reading it in a single sitting. You have to feel the whole arc of it and the experience of it. Now, you will never be able to read a novel that way. You won't be able to know where a reader's going to stop and pick up again. And so you can never sit down and read your novel the way a reader is going to read it.
When you're working on a short story, do you tend to sketch out the arc of the story in one sitting and in your first sitting?
In my mind, sure. I usually write the beginning and then I write the end and then I write the middle last. So I have a sense of its parameters and a sense of its shape.
Now, this seems to be a wonderful moment in short stories. Now.
Oh,
I mean, there are all these great short story writers out there.
Right.
More so, I would guess, than 20 years ago, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know about more so than 20 years ago, but more so than 100 years ago. Absolutely. I think right now North America kind of owns the short story. And it's been nourished in any number of ways. You know, Canada has Alice Munro and up until last month had Mavis Gallant. And the United States has had a lot of people who have had their short stories supported, nourished, encouraged by university life, MFA programs, writing programs, and a culture of small journals. Now, the commercial aspect of short stories is mostly gone, but that has sort of purified it, I think. It used to be Fitzgerald could publish a story in the 30s in Redbook for $15,000, which is the equivalent of like $250,000 or something.
Wow.
I mean, it's a lot of money. But those days are gone. I mean, short stories used to be a way for novelists to fund their novels. And that's what Fitzgerald did. But now that's gone. And people are really devoted to short stories as an art, a literary art form in and of itself. And there's just beautiful examples of it.
Do you have a preference, writing short stories or novels?
I don't know. You know, I've written more short stories than novels, but my last book before this one was a novel. And I got very fond of the narrator, and I was really reluctant to let her go. And she sat on my desk for years. And then, when I turned it all in, knowing that there were still problems, I found I missed her so much. And I thought, that's really crazy. And so that kind of intense relationship with the world of a novel and with a character in it is something that you don't quite have with short stories. Short stories, you assemble a cast of characters and then you get rid of them. After 20 pages, they are gone.
Laurie Moore's new collection of short stories is called Bark. And we didn't have time to air their full conversation, but Steve and Laurie also kicked around the question of whether TV is the new novel. If you want to hear the rest of the interview, it's on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.